Well, hello, listeners and friends. Welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, and today we're going to tackle a case and topic that when I first started researching, I really didn't know exactly how I felt about. I find both sides of this very compelling, and I hadn't really made up my mind. I'm willing to bet some of you are going to wrestle with this also. I'd forgotten about this case, which comes out of Massachusetts, going back initially to the year 2014. At the heart of this case is a very simple question. What are the limits of criminal liability for nothing but words? If a person is 50 miles away, communicating by text message or phone call, can these communications be the foundation for criminal charges when they serve only to encourage the recipient to take action? We all know that free speech doesn't give people the right to say anything and everything whenever and wherever they decide they want to. There are limitations. But the boundaries in the area of speech typically are defined by the effects that they cause. I know some people out there are thinking to themselves, well, you can join a conspiracy just by agreeing to participate, right? But actually, no, the rule of conspiracy is not only agreement, but the commission of an overt act. Just saying that you're in is not enough. You actually have to do something in order to further the goals of the conspiracy, in order to be criminally liable. Today's case is about words, texts, and phone calls. And the question of the day, can words kill? Where does individual autonomy end, and where does the power to command and control someone else's actions, even to their own death, begin? On Sunday, July 13th, 2014, the body of an 18-year-old boy by the name of Conrad Roy was found. He'd committed suicide by filling his truck with carbon monoxide fumes in a Kmart parking lot in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. After his body was discovered, his phone was examined. There were literally thousands of text messages from his girlfriend commanding Roy to end his own life, imploring him to kill himself, mocking him for failing to do so, encouraging him, instructing him on how to fill his truck with carbon monoxide, and guiding him as to location. She went so far as to promise to comfort his family when he was gone and make sure that they knew that he loved them. She was arrested for involuntary manslaughter, and the nation watched with bated breath as the New Bedford Juvenile Court in Taunton, Massachusetts, grappled with whether the mere sending of texts and speaking over the phone carried criminal responsibility for someone who actually followed through and committed suicide. This is the Commonwealth of Massachusetts versus Michelle Carter. Michelle Carter was born August 11, 1996, in Plainville, Massachusetts, to David and Gail Carter. Michelle had a typical suburban upbringing. Her father was a sales manager for a forklift supplier, and her mother staged interiors for real estate agents. Growing up, as a child, she was chatty and outgoing. In middle school, she was a star athlete and had a lot of friends. But by the time she entered ninth grade, she'd become to struggle with depression. She was on psychiatric medication from the time she was 14 years old. There's some indication that she also struggled with self-injurious behaviors like cutting while she was enrolled in King Philip Regional High School. But by all accounts, she was still relatively popular, despite fighting her demons. She was voted class clown and was known for making people laugh. Her classmates would later say that there were indications that she was masking her own problems by being so bubbly with others. In 2012, when she was 15, her family took a trip to Naples, Florida, to visit Carter's grandparents. While there, she met a boy named Conrad Roy, whose family was in Naples visiting Roy's great aunt, who happened to be friendly with Carter's grandparents. Roy, she learned, lived a little less than an hour away from her in Massachusetts. He was a year older, tall and athletic, but extremely socially anxious and depressed. The two felt close to each other immediately. They exchanged numbers and began dating. Conrad Roy III was born September 12, 1995, to Conrad Roy Jr. and Lynn. His grandfather was Conrad Sr., his father was Conrad Jr., who people called Co. So Roy's friends and family called him Coco. He was born and grew up in Mattapoisett, Massachusetts, a small coastal town about 65 miles south of Boston. He had two younger sisters. Conrad Sr. owned a tugboat company, and his father was very active in the business. So growing up, Roy spent a lot of time on boats. He was close with his father and grandfather, and it seemed as though he was poised to go into the family business. He got his captain's license at the age of 18 in early 2014. Like Carter, Roy was popular in high school. He was a good-looking kid. He was athletic. He ran track, he rode on the crew team, and played baseball for Old Rochester Regional High School. But he also struggled terribly with crippling social anxiety and depression. Roy had a history of suicidal thoughts and ideation. Despite having loving and supportive parents, at 17 years old, he overdosed on acetaminophen, the active ingredient in Tylenol, and ended up being rushed to the hospital. Roy went to several therapists, counselors, and psychologists, but his depression persisted and got worse. Carter and Roy had a typical teenage romance. They thought they were in love and told each other so. They texted each other constantly. They shared secrets, complained about family, and talked about their emotional issues. They dated for around 2 years and were in a relationship when Roy overdosed on Tylenol. For much of the relationship, Carter was a support system for Roy. She encouraged him, tried to build up his self-esteem. She encouraged him to get help at McLean Hospital, which specialized in children with psychiatric disorders, and where Carter herself received counseling. But eventually, Roy's repeated pronouncements of how much pain he was in and how he wanted to end his own life caused a change in Carter. Instead of encouraging him to get help, she started encouraging him to kill himself. You can find transcripts of the texts they exchanged online from various sources. I'll warn you, they're heartbreaking to read. Roy professes his love for Carter over and over again. He thanks her for understanding him. And in return, Carter tells Roy that she also loves him and encourages him to take action and end his own life and pain instead of overthinking it and chickening out. In June 2014, Roy graduated from high school with a 3.88 GPA. He'd been accepted to Fitchburg State University, but had elected not to attend. The idea of going to college triggered too much anxiety and depression. On July 12, 2014, Roy's family went to the beach. His mother, Lynn, recalled trying to speak to him while he just kept looking at his phone and texting, basically ignoring her. She could tell something was bothering him more than usual, but he just wouldn't open up to her. He seemed distracted on the car ride home from the beach. He went right to his room. A little while later, he emerged, telling her that he was going to a friend's house and not to expect him home for dinner. That was the last time she ever saw her son alive. Conrad Roy III drove the few minutes to a Kmart parking lot in nearby Fairhaven. He had a combustible engine generator with him. He rigged a hose to direct carbon monoxide from the generator engine into the truck. This was in the evening, but there was nobody else in the parking lot. His body was discovered the following morning, dead from carbon monoxide poison. Roy's family was devastated. Law enforcement sought permission to access Roy's phone, which the family agreed to give. They were surprised to find that Roy had wiped out all of his text messages except those with Carter. The police officers began to scroll through the thread, which had messages going back to 2012. They were appalled to discover that starting around the beginning of July 2014, Carter had begun aggressively pushing Roy to kill himself. In the week leading up to Roy's suicide, Carter herself started bringing it up with Roy. She would send messages asking if he was planning to kill himself that day. For instance, in one exchange, Roy wrote to Carter, "How was your day?" Her response was, "When are you doing it?" My day was okay. How was yours? They make a little small talk, but then Carter brings it back. Roya's telling her about going to work, and she writes, "When are you going to do it? Stop ignoring the question." Exchanges like that were increasingly frequent in Roy's final week, and it always clearly revolved around his decision to kill himself. Police were also shocked to see Carter explain to Roy how to manipulate a carbon monoxide hose into a car. She suggested locations, parking lots, for him to do it. When Roy seemed to waffle, she would mock him, insinuate that he was a coward, or she would encourage him and tell him that things would be so much better if he would just stop thinking about it and just do it. The police saw that right around the time of death, there was a phone call between the two of them for about 45 minutes. But Carter had not called 911 or Roy's parents or anyone to try and get Roy help. Frankly, the police didn't really know what to do, and I find this completely understandable. It was a situation none of the investigators had ever encountered before. It was almost too absurd to be believed that any person would seriously encourage any other individual, especially someone they were dating, to commit suicide is nearly incomprehensible. Carter and Roy, despite only living about an hour from each other, only saw each other in person a handful of times over the 2 years of their relationship. The vast majority of their communications were through text, so there were thousands upon thousands of text messages. There were thousands of texts from July of 2014 alone. The two were in constant communication, and in July, Carter was pushing Roy very hard to commit suicide. The police contacted the Bristol County District Attorney's Office. Ultimately, on February 4th, 2015, more than 6 months after Roy's suicide, Michelle Carter was arrested and indicted by a grand jury for wantonly and recklessly assisting a suicide. In Massachusetts, at the time, these actions constituted involuntary manslaughter. In Massachusetts, a person commits involuntary manslaughter when the following three elements are met. First, that the defendant caused an unlawful, while unintentional, killing. In other words, there was no legal justification for the killing. This wasn't something done in self-defense. And the defendant intended to commit the act or conduct that ultimately caused the death. However, the prosecutor does not need to prove that the death was the intended result, merely that the actions taken by the defendant were done intentionally. Second, the prosecutor has to establish that the victim's death was caused by wanton or reckless conduct, meaning that the defendant's actions created a high degree of likelihood that substantial and serious harm would result to another person. And third, that wanton or reckless conduct that the defendant engaged in actually resulted and caused the victim's death. The Bristol County District Attorney charged Carter with involuntary manslaughter on the theory that the active encouragement of Roy to kill himself was the wanton and reckless conduct which led to his death. In Massachusetts, there's no mandatory minimum sentence for a conviction for involuntary manslaughter, but the defendant can be imprisoned up to a maximum of 20 years. As we've discussed, Michelle Carter was 17 at the time. Now, each state is free to make their own determinations regarding at what age a person can be charged as an adult and under what circumstances. In 2014, Massachusetts, a person between the ages of 7 and 17 is charged as a delinquent minor rather than as an adult. These cases are heard in the juvenile court. The names of the defendants are withheld from the public, and the proceedings cannot be covered by the media. The maximum penalty for any offense committed by a juvenile is commitment in the Department of Youth Services until the 18th birthday of the defendant. The only crime which a person cannot be charged with as a juvenile delinquent is murder. But there's another layer to keep in mind here. I promise we won't go too deep into this, but it is rather important to keep in mind. There's a provision in Massachusetts law where a person is sort of between a juvenile delinquent and an adult offender. Massachusetts has a carve-out called the youthful offender, which applies to people aged 14 to 17. If they do something serious enough, they will be indicted as a youthful offender. And what this means is that while the case stays in juvenile court, because the person isn't 18 yet, the protections of being a juvenile delinquent are now removed. Sentencing for a youthful offender is the same as that of an adult. The trials are public. The names are not withheld. The same evidentiary rules apply in juvenile court as they would in the adult criminal courts. Think of youthful offender status as a way for the prosecutors to charge people under the age of 18 with more serious felonies while still taking into account that they are not legally adults. Carter was charged with involuntary manslaughter as a 17-year-old. She was given youthful offender status, allowing her to be sentenced as an adult. Carter's family hired Joseph Cataldo and Corey Madera, Massachusetts defense attorneys. Naturally, Cataldo first tried to get the case reduced to juvenile delinquency. If successful, the worst thing that could happen then would be that Carter would be able to be put in a juvenile hall until her 18th birthday, which was quickly approaching anyway. That attempt quickly failed. Cataldo then filed a motion to disqualify the Bristol County District Attorney's Office because the district attorney himself, Thomas Quinn, was cousins with Roy's grandmother. But D.A. Quinn had already put the case in the exclusive control of his deputy, William McCauley. So accordingly, that motion was also denied. In early 2016, Cataldo filed a motion to dismiss the indictment on the grounds that there was insufficient probable cause to sustain the indictment. That was also denied. The case was scheduled to go to trial June 6, 2017, more than 2 years after Carter's arrest. On June 5, 2017, the day before the trial is set to begin, Carter's attorneys informed the Honorable Judge Lawrence Moniz that Carter was waiving a jury and would proceed as a bench. For those of you who don't sit in courtrooms all day, if a person is charged with a crime where the maximum possible penalty is 1 year in jail or more, they have a constitutional right to a jury trial. It's the defendant's choice, and in most situations, there are advantages to having a jury. The biggest one is that it requires the unanimity to convict. If even one member of the jury holds out and says not guilty, the defendant has not been convicted of a crime. But sometimes, defendants think it would be better not to have their case heard by a jury, and in those situations, the defendant has the option to waive a jury and put the case in the hands of the judge alone. We say colloquially that judges sit on the bench, so when a defendant waives a jury trial, it's referred to as a bench trial. A bench trial means that the same judge acts as the finder of fact and the finder of law. Okay, so Michelle Carter decided that it would be to her advantage to have Judge Moniz handle the entirety of the case rather than a jury. I've never spoken to Michelle Carter, Joseph Cataldo, or Corey Madera, but I do have some guesses as to why they decided to do this. The text message manslaughter case was a national sensation. Coverage about Michelle Carter was not flattering. The texts were splayed over the news. She was vilified in the media, and pretty much everyone had an opinion about her. Sometimes, when a client is so universally reviled, it makes sense not to want a jury hearing the case after years of reading media stories about what a terrible person the client is. Other times, when the defense wants to argue a specific defense which is hyper-technical or complicated or is based on legal theory rather than something a jury can really bite into easier, it makes sense to waive the jury and assume that the judge will have an easier time understanding what you're trying to say. The lead prosecutor assigned to the case by Deputy McCauley was Katie Rayburn. Rayburn was known in the Bristol County District Attorney's Office as a very formidable attorney. At the time of the Carter trial, she had tried 14 murder cases and won 13 of them. Now, as a prosecutor, your trial strategy has to be amended a bit depending on whether you are dealing with a jury or a judge. Juries make decisions based on emotion. They're susceptible to arguments based on what is right as opposed to what is legal. Judges tend to be a bit more rigid. They don't need the song and dance. They are more apt to make final decisions based on the letter of the law as opposed to how they feel about applying it. Obviously, these are broad generalizations, and there's a lot of variation and exceptions. But in broad strokes, this is more or less how the legal industry perceives judges and juries. You can definitely tell the difference in behavior by talented attorneys. They play up for a jury. It's more theatrical, more dramatic. It's a bit song and dance, entertainment, and hyperbolic. In front of a judge, it's subdued, respectful, direct, and on point. Despite hearing that Carter was going to proceed as a bench trial the day prior to what she anticipated would be jury selection, Rayburn didn't miss a beat. She stripped the prosecution case of flash. Her narrative for Judge Moniz was simple and often repeated. She said that Carter's actions, encouraging Roy to kill himself for days, weeks, and even months, as well as directly at the time of his suicide, made her criminally guilty of Roy's death regardless of whether she was physically present or not. She said that Carter desperately wanted to be viewed as a tragic figure and thought she would get lots of attention and sympathy if her boyfriend killed himself. Carter's phone messages show that she thought Roy killing himself would bring a huge focus and outpouring of love and support to her. The defense offered several different arguments. They argued that this case represented a severe overreach on involuntary manslaughter law. In a nutshell, Cataldo and Matera claimed that Carter was nowhere near Roy when this happened. Roy had been suicidal since before he even met Carter. He was planning to kill himself. Carter's text messages didn't force him to turn the generator on and funnel its exhaust into his truck. Roy, the defense argued, was a tragically suicidal young man who committed suicide. Nothing that Carter did or didn't do was ultimately going to change that fact. The defense also argued that the First Amendment protected Carter's speech. There was no direct action taken by Carter at the time, according to the defense team, which caused harm to Roy. It was all words. Now, this is a really interesting argument. So let's take a moment and examine the limits of constitutionally protected speech in the United States. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protects speech, but over time, Congress and the Supreme Court have set limitations. You may have heard someone claim that they can say anything they want because they have free speech, and then perhaps you heard someone reply, well, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. I bring up this example to put to bed this misconception. The fire in a crowded theater analysis was originally put forth by Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes in a 1919 decision which sought to limit free speech. Advocates for regulating speech now use this analogy as a catch-all for the argument that speech can rightly be limited and regulated under certain circumstances. The irony is that the case which produced that particular phrase and analogy was overturned in 1969, and that ruling was determined to impermissibly limit speech. So it turns out that you can, actually, yell fire into a crowded theater, though I still don't recommend doing it. It's not illegal. The important difference here is that this newer case, Brandenburg v. Ohio, changed the law as it related to regulating speech which was deemed incitement. The prohibition against yelling fire in a crowded theater era used a test which said that if speech caused a clear and present danger, it was not protected. In Brandenburg v. Ohio, the clear and present danger test was scrapped in favor of the imminent lawless action standard. Under the new standard, the Supreme Court explicitly stated that mere advocacy was protected. Only speech which was intended to incite immediate violence was rightly prohibited. Accordingly, one could advocate for the violent overthrow of the United States government so long as the circumstances of the speech did not indicate that violence should take place right at that moment. The First Amendment argument was carefully considered by Judge Moniz. Cataldo argued that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts never intended to criminalize this type of speech and the defendant must be acquitted as a result. Sounds kind of like a reasonable argument, doesn't it? Claiming that the law has never been used in a certain way before can be a very powerful argument that it was never intended to be and consequently should not be. The more commonplace a legal theory becomes, the easier it is to argue that it's an appropriate exercise of state power. But if it's never been done before, it should make law enforcement stop and wonder whether they're crossing lines that they shouldn't be. But Cataldo's claim wasn't entirely accurate. Judge Moniz was actually able to dig up a 200-year-old case, Commonwealth v. Bowen, in which a prisoner, George Bowen, repeatedly and frequently advised and urged a fellow prisoner, Jonathan Jewett, to kill himself. Jewett did so by hanging himself in his cell the night before he was supposed to be executed. Bowen was found guilty of murder for his counseling Jewett to kill himself and the man actually doing it. Despite nobody in Massachusetts being arrested and charged under this theory for 200 years, it was enough for Judge Moniz to declare that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts does not protect this type of speech. The issue, according to Judge Moniz, was whether the texts were made with criminal intent. Let's take a look at the evidence regarding intent that came up at the trial. The prosecution introduced a number of videos of Roy, which he filmed of himself in the months leading up to his death. In some of them, he appeared optimistic and hopeful about the future. He'd been offered a job captaining a duck tours boat. He was extremely proud of that. But other videos really showcased his depression. He refers to himself at times as trash, claims he will never be successful, will have no life, never have kids, will never learn. These videos were intended to show that Roy was not as suicidal as the defense was making him out to be, but really ended up being a double-edged sword, as the range of emotions displayed on the videos clearly demonstrated a boy in real distress. Perhaps the most significant piece of evidence on Carter's state of mind was generated about 2 months after Roy's death. Carter was texting another friend and wrote that while Roy was in the truck filling up with carbon monoxide, at one point he left, gasping for air, while they were on the phone together. She ordered him to get back in. He did, and died. Law enforcement knew that Carter and Roy had a roughly 45-minute phone call around the time that Roy died, but they didn't know the contents of that call until they saw Carter's additional text messages sent after the fact. Rayburn, the prosecutor, was then able to argue that Carter was literally on the phone with Roy as he died. She didn't call 911. She didn't call his parents. She didn't call anyone to try and get help. She literally heard him try to save himself and ordered him back into a box of poison where he died. Looking through Carter's phone also revealed that in the time leading up to Roy's suicide, while she is actively texting with him and encouraging him to kill herself, she's telling her other friends that she doesn't know where he is and hasn't heard from him in days. To some others, she wrote that Roy was in a bad place. This is where the defense stumbled a bit. Rayburn had these texts in black and white, displayed for the judge to read himself. She didn't need to do anything other than put them on a board. They spoke for themselves. To counter, the defense tried to show that Roy was sending suicidal messages for years. He had a history of depression, and his other attempted suicide had nothing to do with Carter. They also introduced past texts where Carter encouraged him to get help and was supportive of him. Cataldo and Madera had to know that Carter's behavior would be taken by the judge as consciousness of guilt. Her actions were not that of a friend or girlfriend trying to get help or save Roy. They sought to persuade him to end his life directly at the moment when he died. So the defense team called Dr. Peter Bregan, a psychiatrist who had conducted a forensic evaluation of Michelle Carter. Carter did not ever assert a mental illness defense, but she did introduce psychiatric testimony in order to argue that she did not have the requisite criminal mental state, at the time of the alleged criminal action. Dr. Breggin was known for his very public skepticism of antidepressant drugs, which Carter had been on for some time. His testimony was that these medications may have impaired Carter to the point where she was not even able to form intent in her mind, and she didn't really know what was going on or what she was saying. Antidepressants, according to Dr. Breggin, transform people and change their personality. Unfortunately, it doesn't seem that Judge Moniz put a lot of stock in the testimony of Dr. Breggin. The witness sparred a lot with the prosecutor on cross-examination, but also with the defense attorney who is conducting his direct, and he even exchanged some nasty words with Judge Moniz himself. Dr. Breggin also claimed that Conrad Roy was the dominant partner in the relationship, and that Roy had coerced a vulnerable and depressed Michelle Carter into supporting his plan to commit suicide over her objection. At one point, Rayburn was characterizing Carter as someone who feigned concern for people in order to win attention, and Dr. Breggin interrupted her question to say, "Well, you're making her sound manipulative." Rayburn stared back at Dr. Breggin and simply said, "Yes." The response drew some laughter in the well in the courtroom, as Dr. Breggin was in the process of being thoroughly discredited. Rayburn crossed Dr. Breggin on why he changed his original finding that Carter was mentally stable to that she was clinically depressed and suffered from extreme anxiety a few weeks before the trial began. He didn't really have a good answer. She also asked if his evaluation took into account that Carter was simultaneously flirting via text with one boy while telling another friend she was in the middle of cutting her wrists and hands. Dr. Breggin simply repeated, often in long-winded, rambling answers, that Rayburn simply didn't understand Carter. The trial lasted 10 days. At the conclusion of the trial, Judge Moniz convicted Carter of involuntary manslaughter. The text messages he relayed in his decision were not what led him to believe that she was guilty. It was the fact that she was speaking to Roy on the phone while he was in the truck. Roy left the truck, and that, to Judge Moniz, indicated a clear desire to abandon the suicide attempt. At that point, she overbore his will and ordered him to get back into the truck and kill himself, which he did. It was wanton and reckless to demand that he return to the truck when he had broken the chain of self-causation by getting out. Despite the maximum sentence for the crime being a possible 20 years in prison, Carter served just 15 months. Her conviction was affirmed in the Massachusetts court system, was appealed to the Supreme Court for the First Amendment issue, but the Supreme Court declined to take the case, so the ruling remained. In summation, to really get at the heart of this case, you have to divorce the emotional aspect of it out. There's no question that it is morally abhorrent to encourage someone to end their own life so that you might get some attention for having suffered the tragedy of losing them. Morality and the law often walk hand in hand. But it's important to remember that just because something is immoral, it does not always follow that it's also criminal. People do horrible things to each other every single day, which don't specifically violate some criminal statute, but which society would generally conclude should not have been done. At the time of this case, Massachusetts was one of 11 states which did not have an explicit crime in its penal code, making it illegal to encourage a suicide. As I said at the beginning of this episode, when I first started looking into the underlying issue of this case, I was torn. From an ethics standpoint, I don't really lose any sleep from Carter going to prison for what she did, and for longer than 15 months. But was this really involuntary manslaughter? Let's look back at that statute one more time for guidance, and remember, these are the elements. The defendant caused the victim's death. The conduct which caused the death was done intentionally, even if the death was not the intended result. The defendant's conduct was wanton and reckless, meaning that the person consciously disregarded a significant risk that substantial injury or death could occur. In my view, the result of this case revolves around the word caused. We tend to think of causation differently than as it was applied to this case. To cause something means to physically bring it about. Driving a car or firing a gun is an intentional action which causes results. It's those types of activities which we generally associate with disregarding a risk and potentially unintentionally causing someone's death. In this case, we're talking about text messages and phone calls. Judge Moniz's decision clearly indicated that he felt that the phone call caused Roy to get back in the truck. But after reading it, I'm not sure that I'm convinced about that. For that to be true, we have to accept as fact that Conrad Roy lacked any semblance of free will. That hearing an instruction from a person 35 miles away was somehow so binding on his psyche that he was not physically capable of saying no or disobeying. There is no debate whatsoever that Roy was alone when he got in the car. And despite Rayburn's very articulate argument that with the ubiquity of cell phones, we are now actually there with people even when we're not physically present, I think that goes too far. The fact is that Michelle Carter was not in the Kmart parking lot. She didn't push Roy into the truck. She didn't point a knife or a gun at him, order him back into the car. I can already visualize the feedback that this position is going to get. I know some of you out there are saying to yourselves, but Paul, she knew better than anyone that he was suicidal, that he was easily manipulated, that he was depressed. She should have known that telling this particular person under these particular conditions to kill himself would be different than saying it to a stranger on the street. Now, I fully understand that argument. I just think in this particular context, it doesn't carry the day, and I'll explain why. Victimology matters, and what I mean by that is that a person's unique conditions or characteristics may, in some situations, render actions done to them criminal when they wouldn't necessarily be if done to someone else. For example, if you know that your elderly neighbor has a serious heart condition and has a phobia of clowns, you put on a clown costume and scream at your neighbor's window in the middle of the night, causing them to have a heart attack and die, you could be charged for that homicide, even if you doing that to your neighbor on the other side would merely irritate them and probably get a phone call to the police. But here's why I can't fully buy in to this argument. It's because I believe in free will and autonomy. I believe Conrad Roy did have a choice. I believe he was an extremely troubled kid who struggled with depression and had even previously attempted suicide. Did Michelle Carter play a role in his ultimate suicide? Indisputably. Did she cause it? Was she the reason that it happened? Was she the foundational cause of Conrad Roy ending his own life to the point where she could be charged with his death? I don't believe so. Being a contributing factor, even a pretty influential one, is not the same as causation. And I think when something like this happens, when true tragedy strikes, society has a need to identify who is to blame and implement some sort of punishment. We human beings are so uncomfortable with lacking closure. We are always seeking to explain, to understand. But I think things happen in this world that we will never understand. And sometimes trying to make sense of them compounds the harm. I want to be crystal clear. I am not defending Michelle Carter's actions. As I said earlier, morally, I find her conduct inexcusable, and I think she certainly played a leading role in Conrad Roy's death. But at the same time, I am troubled with the idea that the courts can determine that you caused something merely by telling someone else to do it. Perhaps certain relationships could make that connection. A parent telling a 16-year-old to do something, a boss or manager speaking to a subordinate employee, that kind of thing. But what we're discussing here is just two kids. With all due respect to Judge Moniz, who had an incredibly difficult decision to make here, I simply cannot get behind the legal theory that Carter's voice over the phone caused, in a legal sense, Conrad Roy to get back in the truck. That was, at the end of the day, a voluntary action that he took. He was certainly pressured by Carter, but pressure isn't causation. I'm also less likely to base a verdict on a legal theory established in 1816 and not applied since then. In 1816, the world was a different place. The right thing to do here was to acknowledge that the law has failed to take this situation into account. Have a debate in the legislature about whether to criminalize encouraging suicide. And then, if the people want it, pass a law and let everyone know that going forward, if you encourage someone to kill themselves and they do it based on your counsel, you can be prosecuted. Convicting Carter for involuntary manslaughter because of a phone call was, I think, the wrong answer. So that's what happened in Commonwealth of Massachusetts v. Michelle Carter. Now you can amaze your friends with your knowledge of incitement, First Amendment law, and how words can kill. As always, a special thank you to Dan Townsend, my audio engineer, without whom the audio quality of these shows would be disastrous. I'd also like to thank my law clerk, Alex Berlingeri, who recommended today's topic and reminded me about this great case to look into, so thank you. And thanks again to everyone who reaches out via email, Twitter, and now Instagram. I will do my best to keep getting content out. And speaking of, if you'd like to get in touch with me, leave me feedback, recommend a case or legal issue to discuss on the show, leave a comment at the show's website, insummation.com. Or you can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet me at insummationpod, find me on Instagram at insummation. Or you can look me up the old-fashioned way on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. As those of you who have reached out know, I do try and respond to every message that I get, because I really appreciate them. Even those of you who very civilly and courteously disagree with me. If you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe on whatever platform you listen on so you'll automatically get the next one when it comes out. And check out all the previous episodes. Until next time, thanks for stopping by, and I hope you'll come back for more.